Sir, are there any questions about the last lecture? Right, so in the last lecture, I guess that the main thing that we did is to understand how, in a cohomological theory, the operators fit into families. And the families are completely separated into a collection of primary operators that are the ones that transform the tensors and the cohomological transformations. And in fact, I could ask how many primary operators in the state we have. Above two dimensions, necessarily we must have an infinite number of them. So when I say that we have to list the number of primary operators, it's actually the infinite. The exception to that in two dimensions because if we have two dimensions, it's simply because the algebra is infinite dimensional, and you may see some of that later in the course. And then there are the descendants, which are just obtained by acting with the original operator of the conformal algebra, which is the operator P mu, which acts as derivative of the block. And intuitively, it's very clear that the correlation functions of the primary operator, the correlation functions are determined for the descendant because you take derivative. But notice that the primaries transform very nicely as tensors, and the other ones, they don't transform as nicely. So, for example, a primary operator has the property that if it's at the origin, and for example, under the special conformal transformation, if you get annihilated, that's not true if the operator is not at the origin. That's not surprising because in order to move the operator away from the origin, you have to conjugate by translation, and P and K don't commute, so you're going to get something. But if you look at the descendant, for example, just the derivative of a primary, that operator is not here at the origin. So if you remember, when we did the special conformal transformation, you had a translation piece, but actually the translation generated by the vector, right? You have something like delta O. But the vector for a special conformal transformation is quadratic in the axis, right? So it vanishes at the origin. And then you had the so in particular, you had a local dilatation where this delta of x, so this not a coincidence, but I don't know, it's lambda, so this was the dilatation, plus something like.
Excuse me.
Can you
listen on the mic, please?
Oh, yeah.
Thanks.
I'm not repeating all
of it. Okay. That's better, yeah. So you see, for example, now, so this is how it transforms, right? So imagine, let's look only at the what you get by doing a special conformal transformation. So here there was also rotation, right? We call it omega mu nu, whatever, L mu nu acting on O. And this omega mu nu was something like B mu x nu minus B nu x mu. So you see that for the primary, it vanishes. The all terms vanish, right? Because the vector field has a zero. And all the rotations and the induced rotation and the induced dilatation vanishes. But if I look at the descendant, for example, there is a term that acts as a derivative here that will not be zero. Good. So the point is that they organize in these infinite families and will make very important role of this today. So the thing that you will elaborate in the next tutorial or homework or whatever the name is called is that the conformal symmetry has a remarkable property, is that it completely fixes the position dependence of 2 and 3 point functions. And since I said, if I tell you the 2 and 3 point functions are the primaries, you automatically know the 2 and 3 point functions are the descendants because you just take derivatives. Good. And this is true for operators of all spin. So I emphasize that operators are labeled by 2 quantum numbers, the dimension. This is the main thing that we care about, the scaling dimensions. This has to do with critical exponents. When you study CFT, when you study a system near a critical point, then you know how thermodynamic quantities have some scaling behavior. That scaling behavior is exactly encoded in these dimensions of operators. So when you study statistical mechanics and you had these weird letters, alpha, beta, gamma, about how the heat capacity blows up and all of that has to do with the spectrum of these deltas. Okay. And if you remember from well, if you, I don't know if you ever saw that, but you know, there were weird laws that how different critical exponents had relations, and every law had a weird name. And that's another example of how physics simplifies things. All those relations that were found phenomenologically is just a direct consequence of a symmetry. You can derive them just from the property that the theory has a scaling symmetry. Good. So just for simplicity, when I write formulas, I want to write formulas for scalar operators. I mean, scalars under the Lorentz group. But you can do it for any spin. And the statement is still true, that the 2 and the 3-point function of an operator with arbitrary spin is also completely fixed. The position dependence is completely fixed. So let's start with the 2-point function. So this is something you're going to try to be consistent with my O's. So you can go to an orthogonal basis, and it looks like this, where I'm defining xij to be the Poincaré invariant distance between the points I and j. And here you see that you can read off the dimension of the operator by reading the fall-off behavior of its 2-point function. So if you're a theorist or you do numerics and you want to extract deltas, you want to measure some correlation function, and then you want to read off the tails as a power law. And then the 3-point function is also completely fixed. And you're going to derive this relation in the exercises. So now here there's an important tensor that comes in, Cijk, that tells you, if you wish, how these three operators couple. It's a little bit like in quantum mechanics, when you have two representations and they fuse, there's kind of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that tell you how these things fuse. So this is the analog of that. So from here we extract what I will call the CFT data, which is the collection of all dimensions of your primaries. To be precise, I should say it should be the pair, dimension, and Lorentz spin. Okay. But I'm not going to keep writing the Lorentz spin. So you have to give me the dimensions of all operators for all spins. But for once, I'll write it like this. So you have, this is one part of the data that's extracted from the 2-point function. And this guy, and then the structure constant. Okay? So we call these guys the structure constants. Good. And for example, one way that you convince that you're at least in the right track is that we know that under dilatations, which is the kind of the hero, well, this is the guy that we want to diagonalize. We know that under dilatations, the operator transforms like this, okay? So in order to see that this behavior at least is consistent with that, is that you count dimensions. So here I have two operators of the same dimension. So it goes like lambda to the minus two delta. And that's exactly, if every scale x is, you get lambda to the minus two delta. In here you have three different operators, so this scales like delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3. And if you sum all these three numbers twice, you get delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3. It is very important to say that if you only imposed scale invariants, so dilatation invariants, but not special conformal transformations, this you would be allowed to have a, this would not be completely fixed. So actually, special conformal transformations play a very important role in completely fixing the three-point function. If you only impose Poincaré plus dilatation, this would not be true. Okay? So these extra weird generators are, actually have a lot of teeth. They really fix the whole thing. Good. Good. So I asked last lecture, and the answer was yes, that you've come across the notion of a word identity. So that's just a way of imposing the relations between that symmetries of your system impose in your correlation functions. So you can derive this by solving the word identities. So one, there are many ways of thinking about it. Let me tell you one that it's simple enough. So essentially, a word identity is a statement you have a symmetry, and it tells you that the correlation functions of a collection of operators equals the correlation functions of the transform operators evaluated at the same space-time point. Okay, that's what a symmetry is. So in equations, it means this. I'm not going to put indices everywhere, but I think this always did not be the same operator, but you know, not to put indices everywhere. That's a statement that the correlation function is symmetric, okay? Perhaps another way that you have seen this is that you can look now at an infinitesimal transformation. So this is true for a finite transformation. So in particular, this would be true for inversion, for example. But now you can look at an infinitesimal transformation. And what is the word identity? It's just a statement that you have a correlation function and the variation under that symmetry of the entire correlation function has to vanish, okay? So what is this in equation? So you sum over I from 1 to n. You have O x1 delta O xn, sorry, xi up to O xn. So what I did is what this means is that the variation of the product of all these operators have to vanish. But you know that the variation obeys the Leibniz rule. So this is just implementing the Leibniz rule of the delta of the product of the operators. Okay. So I'm sure this is something you're very well known, and that's it. And now you can derive these equations if you wish, using the fact that what I more or less I wrote there. Since you know what delta O is, okay, for a primary, what this implies, one way to interpret this equation is as a differential equation. And the solution of the differential equation is this. Okay. Good. So our next task is to study the four-point function. So you could think that this goes on with this. These miracles goes on forever, and the answer is it doesn't go on forever, and I'm going to explain why it doesn't go forever. And then you may worry that there is an infinite amount of new other data that the four-point function will give you completely new data that I have to solve, and then the five-point function will give completely new data that I have to solve, and so on. So the thing that's very special about conformal field theories, and we'll try to explain today why, is that if you wish, the entire theory, the entire data that fixes the with caveats, if you will have extended operators, let's just, there are always little technical loopholes that we have to go through. The more we understand things, the more loopholes, for example, the operators that are extended in space-time have become very important in the last few years. So I should qualify those statements if I want to take those into account. But essentially for the statement of local correlation functions, all the entire data of the CFT is completely determined by just this, by the spectrum of dimensions and spins, and by the structural constant of the three-point function. The higher-point functions, if you wish, do not give new data, but actually imply very strong constraints on this data. So right now, when I write this, you could say, I can have any deltas I care. You choose you engineer your CFT. You say, I want delta of the square root of 2 and the square root of 5. And the same with the structural constants. But the thing that's going to be very important is that the higher prime functions implies absolutely non-trivial, non-linear constraints on this data that restricts the space of solutions, of the allowed solutions of this data. Okay. And that should not be surprise, should not surprise you. You know that CFTs in the real world, for example, you have to tune things, right? In order to go to a critical, to find a CFT, like in a magnet, you have to tune very precisely to the critical temperature. So CFTs are kind of sparse, in some sense. And these nonlinear constraints are going to derive, in fact, show that most generic values are not allowed CFTs. Okay. So the constraints that we're going to discuss today, I hope we can discuss it today. So you're okay. So let me make an analogy. So you're familiar with objects with three indices like this from Lie algebras, right? So when you write a Lie algebra, you can say TA, TB equals FIJK and be done with it. Say, okay, I can write any Lie algebra that I want. But then you have to remember something, that you have to satisfy the Jacobi identity, right? So if you wish, the constraints that we're going to impose from the four-point function are to this, like what the Jacobi identity is for Lie algebras. So if you wish, this is kind of a generalization of a notion of a Lie algebra. We have some structure constants, and we have to find some constraints that they have to satisfy. Okay, so let's start with the four-point function. And then along the way, I will give you an intuitive understanding of why the two and the three-point functions are completely fixed by symmetries. So this will require some participation. So let's start with four-point functions. And now let's be in these space-time dimensions. This blackboard is a bit weird, falling apart. Okay. So I have to specify 4 points, the location of the 4 points, x1, x2, x3, x4. But we have symmetries in the problem. So now we're gonna start using symmetries in a clever way. So one thing that I can do is pick one of the, so the thing I want to do is to show you, before showing how to do it, is that I can take 4 points in d-dimensional space-time and use conformal symmetry to map these four points to a plane, okay? So we're gonna show how you do that. And in fact, let's do that, let me start doing it. So one thing I can do, And I'm going to put some of the points in canonical places. Like I'll choose some points that I like, and I'm going to show that I can always put them there. And then, since I put them there, at the end of the day, in order to know what the correlation function will depend on, and in terms of the position dependence, will tell us what parameters I couldn't get rid of. Okay. So let's start with K mu. So if you remember the transformation for K mu, it had a weird denominator, right? So it tells you, that denominator tells you that I can always do a special conformal transformation to take any point to infinity, okay? So I'm gonna like to put this guy at infinity. And of course, this K will transform all these other points. So I should be putting primes everywhere if you want to be precise about it. So X, but let me not do that because by the end of the day, we'll have like 5 primes and it's not going to be nice. But it's clear that if I act on K mu, all the points are moved, right? I'm moving them around. But I'll still call it X3. Now, what else can I do? I mean, another point that we like is 0 at the origin, right? So what can I do to bring, say, X1 to the origin? Yeah?
Translation.
I can do a translation. So I have 0. But the thing that's very important is that I want to do an operation that brings x1 at the origin and doesn't mess up the point already fixed, right? Well, translations don't mess up with infinity, don't mess infinity, so I'm okay. I mean, I want to do a transformation that keeps the fellows that I fixed before where they were and just move the other guys around. So I'm doing good. Now, what else can I do? Oh, okay, so here it tells you something about the two-point function. Notice, what did I do? I'm telling you by using translations and special conformal transformations, I'm able to completely fix the position of 2 points. So that tells you that the position dependence of the two point is completely fixed. I can just put it at those special points, and there is no other degrees of freedom left. Okay. Now we're going to show in the same fashion for the 3-point function. So one thing I can do is I can act with dilatations. This just is a rescaling. So if you wish, I can put the point x3 to live on the unit sphere. So it has unit norm. Okay, so it's a n, yeah, unit vector, unit dimensional vector. Okay, so how am I going to write this? I don't know. Let me call it m. Okay. Okay. But now I can do something. Oh, by the way, I noticed that dilatation. Okay, going back to this, did I lie to you? Notice that the 0 and infinity are fixed points of the dilatation, right? A dilatation transformation does not move 0 or infinity, okay? So I'm not doing anything illegal. Now, what other transformation that I have not used has the property that does not mess 0 and infinity?
Rotations.
0 and infinity is a fixed point of rotations. So now what I can do is bring, so this is an n vector, you know, is a d-dimensional vector on the unit sphere. What I can do is I can do a rotation so that the one axis is aligned with that vector, right? I mean, I think you're familiar with that with quantum mechanics. You can always rotate things so that a chosen unit vector defines the axis. So I'm gonna map this to x2, the vector 1, 0, 0, 0, infinity. Okay, can someone tell me which rotations did I use to go from here to here? So, yeah.
Sorry, what's the question?
So if I give you a d-dimensional vector, and I want to bring a d-dimensional unit vector, and I want to bring it to this canonical form. Well, you know intuitively that you can do it, but imagine I force you, I put a gun to your head, tell me which rotations did I use. Just like here, which transformations did I use, which rotations did I use? You know, rotations are labeled by some tensor, mu nu, right? So which mu nu did I use? Okay, I'll tell you, you think about it, but... because essentially you want to bring the 2, the 3, the 4, up to the coordinates, components of the vector to 0, right? So that means that you have to act with m12, m13, up to m1d. Okay? Good. So now this also explains why the 3-point function, is the position dependence is completely fixed, because I just use conformal symmetries to fix it to 3 arbitrary points that I like. Okay. Now, but is there something else I can do here? So right now I started with 4 times d degrees of freedom, right? I had 4 vectors in the dimension that there are 4 d components. And now I removed the shitloads of them and I'm only left with d components, which is the position of this fellow, okay? But I have not used all my generators. Can I use generators such that I can reduce the degrees of freedom of x2 and not move these guys? Yes?
All the rotations that don't have one.
Sorry?
All the rotations that don't have one.
So let's go that direction. Let's try to do that, yes? So what you can do is rotate, how am I writing this? Okay, I guess this should have been written here, but that's fine. This is very confusing, sorry. So I should write it here. Where's the razor? Okay. So here, what I can do now is do m to 3 up to m to d, okay? And this allows me to bring this to 0, AB, just the first two coordinates, are used, I put all the other coordinates to zero, then 1, 0, 0, and infinity. Okay? And that's it. So you can convince yourself, I mean, just do the counting, that, for example, if we were in three space-time dimensions, we have used, all the m's have been used. Is that clear? Because we did m12, m13, and now we used m23. That's all you have in three dimensions, right? Now, in four dimensions, there is one fellow that we haven't used, which is, if you notice, is m34. Now, can I use M34 to simplify this further? These locations further?
No.
No. So it doesn't buy me any cash. So that's it. That's as much as we can do. Okay? So what this tells you in physical terms is the four-point function, unlike the two and the three-point functions, depends on two coordinates, which call A and B, which are the positions in a plane. And notice that this shows you what I promised, that you can map the four points at the plane. Okay. Now, after all this thing, can someone tell me the number of coordinates or the number of parameters that the correlation function of the endpoint function will depend on? How many parameters will that have? So, so this was a four-point function in endpoint function.
So, like, we treat A and B as like one parameter, or like two?
No, two. It's coordinate X and coordinate Y. And in a second, I'm going to write what's called a cross ratio, which is a more covariant way of expressing the fact that if I give you 4 points, you can construct two conformal invariants given 4 points. Okay. But, yes.
So if I use any of these guys on the last thing that we got, I would necessarily mess up one of the other three, and then I wouldn't. So for example, say I use dilation to.
No, dilation you already used. You're done.
I'm done, because yeah. If I use it, then I mess up the third one, right? The 1, 0, 0 goes to.
No. Dilation would not move 1, 0, 0, 0, right? Yes.
So what? Okay. So why can't I use it to
get the
AB 0, 0, 0 to be somewhere on the unit spheres?
I don't think you can use the same generator twice.
Ah, okay.
So, and that's actually the answer to that. So, what's one way to think about how many parameters you started with and how many you have removed? Is that you start with the total number of parameters is n times d, right? That's the number of components of n vector in the dimensions. And how many parameters can I have is the dimension of the conformal algebra, which is, remember that it was, the Lie algebra is SO2, D, so it's d plus 2 plus d plus 1 divided by 2. And this is the number, so that means that the number of cross ratios or conformal invariant coordinates that you can create out of n points is that number. Okay, so in 4D it's 2. So let's go back to the 4-point function. We can understand the fact that there are two cross ratios, so two conformal invariant characteristics, by looking at this particular ratio x12 x34 square x 1, 3 square, x24 square. Claim that guy is invariant under conformal transformations. So invariant under translations, rotations, and dilatations is obvious, right? That's the thing that's not obvious is the invariant under a special conformal. One way you can commit yourself though in that direction is that it should be pretty obvious to you that it's invariant under inversions. Remember that we discussed inversions and that the special conformal transformations can be obtained by conjugating translations twice, by inversion. So that's one cross ratio, and the other cross ratio can be obtained by flipping 1 and 3. So we call it V. So it will be x 1 4 square, x 2 3 square, and the denominator remains untouched. And now, if you wish, so these are the two famous cross ratios that you can have given 4 points. And now we can try to go to this point. And imagine I introduce a coordinate z, so x plus I, okay, a plus I, b, yeah? And I want to evaluate the cross ratios in these points, right? Zero, z, and blah, blah, okay? So I hope it's clear. So since I'm mapping x4 to infinity, these guys will cancel, right? So if you evaluate in this configuration, what you want to get, the u is z times z bar, because x13 is 1, okay? And x12 is z times z bar. And v, again, these guys cancel because I'm mapping x4 to infinity, so this goes to 1. And x13 divided by x23, and this also goes to 1, and this is 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar. Good. Did I use all the blackboards? I think so. Okay.
Yes, sir. And that formula for counting of number of parameters, it works only for high number of n.
So there can be, like, there can be degeneracies if n is a little bit too small. For example, so let's evaluate that number. Let's see if so that's a true statement. For example, for the four-point function, we said that, in four dimensions, we said that M34 was pointless, right? So here you would have subtracted one too many. Okay? So this is you should always do it carefully like I did here. This formula is definitely true if for n sufficiently large. Actually, I think this formula starts always being true if n equals, at least with n equals 5. Yeah. For example, this formula fails miserably for the 2 and the 3 point function in particular, right? Because for the 2 and the 3 point function, there are no cross ratios. So it's, you have to use a sufficiently large n where you have used everyone. You have used all your fellows. Okay, so now all this analysis is to show that the 4-point function, so now we're going to study the 4-point function. And in order to be less hectic, I'm going to do the 4-point function of 4 identical operators, scalar operators. You can do it. Nothing that I will say conceptually will change if I, instead of 4 identical operators, I use 4 different ones, or I use operators with different spin. It will just create a notational nightmare that I don't want to deal with. All the conceptual points are exactly the same. So now what you can do is, these guys have a scale like 4th delta, right? You have, so this guy has dimension delta phi. So on the left-hand side, I have, if I do a scale transformation, it will scale homogeneously with lambda to the 4 delta. So it means I can choose this guy to be x12 times 2 delta phi, x34 times 2 delta phi. But now, I just told you that u and v are conformal invariant, right? So that means that here I have an arbitrary function, we're going to call g, of the two cross ratios. So while before we just had some constants, here I have arbitrary functions. And this back, we're back to the real world. Like, you're familiar that in Newton field theory, things depend on functions of the coordinates, right? So here we're back to the real world that the four-point function does depend on an arbitrary function. Now, these are 4 identical operators. So, as I said here, since I can replace 1 and 3 just by Bose symmetry, this is the same as GUB. So this I do by exchanging 1 and 3. This exchanges B and U. And it can be written as... I think I messed something up. It's a factor of U somewhere. So and then the ratio of U B to the delta phi. Okay. Good. So now what I want to do is essentially show you that this GUB is known, is not, yes.
Where did this extra factor come from?
Because I'm exchanging 1 and 3. Mm-hmm. So this will go into 2, 3, and 1, 4. So I can put it back and.
See.
Yeah.
Come on,
sir. Yeah. So now the goal will be, as I said, is to say that GUB is not an independent quantity. And actually, it constrains. We will use it to constrain. We will use this equation to constrain the CFT data, delta I and CI JK. OK? So what are we going to use? So now, all this was symmetry, right? Remember that I told you that I give you this lecture, so what is this guy talking about? That symmetries only get you so far. It only parametrizes the most general solution. Now, at some point, we have to impose some dynamics to get actual teeth. So what we're going to use in order to find these constraints is to, we're going to constrain CFT data. By using, there are many ways of saying this, but let me say it this way, associativity of the operator product expansion, okay? So let me tell you what associativity means first. I think you know, but so you have, imagine you have three operators. I'm not gonna write the arguments. You have O1, O2, O3. It shouldn't matter if I first do O3, if I multiply things in this order or this order. Okay. Good. So now, what is this word OPE? So this stands for operator product expansion. Okay. This is a very important notion in field theory, especially in conformal field theories. And you are more or less familiar with it in other contexts. In the following way. So imagine I have a 75-point function, and I want to focus on a pair of operators. So let me look at an operator OI at x1. Let's say OJ at x2. And then OI at x1. Okay. I draw a sphere around both of them. It's important that this sphere should not contain any of the other points. Okay. And now you can view these as a long, as you wish, as a multiple expansion. So from far away, these two guys cannot really be distinguished by some blob, which is you could call a one local operator. This is like the multiple expansion when you do in electromagnetism. You have a charge distribution, but from far away, it's indistinguishable from some charge density with features. So. But what is the most general thing you can have? You can replace this by an operator we're going to call OK, evaluated at x2. And what is this OK? Well, as is always in physics, whatever can appear there is the most general thing that's consistent with the principles of quantum mechanics and symmetries and so on. So what we're going to do, this sum over K is the sum over all operators in your theory. That means the sum over primaries and descendants. Okay. So we're going to write this as C I J K. Of course, translational invariants will say that this depends on x1 minus x2. And I'm going to write this notation and try to explain what this is, okay? So what this does is what are these derivatives? So first, the k, if you wish, is the sum over the primaries, okay? This is a power series in the coordinates and derivatives. This encodes the contribution in the decomposition from the descendants, because you know that the descendants are just derivatives, okay? So I'm writing it formally. This can be spelled out very concretely. But first, I want you to understand what's going on. So you just expand in the most general thing. And you, the way to think about it is that you expand in conformal families, labeled by K. And then this guy takes into account the contribution of the descendants. Now, the thing that's amazing in a conformal field theory is that this expansion has a finite radius of convergence. Okay, and this expansion converges to the next operator, to the position of the next operator. So I have some other operator, it's sitting here. This expansion works all the way to the minimum of the distance of the location of this guy to the next operator. Okay, so the minimum between x2 and xn. Very good. So now, a very important statement. This function is completely fixed. By conformal invariants. There are many, many, many ways of showing this. One way is the following. You have the product of these two operators equals this infinite sum. One way to explicitly compute what this thing is. So first of all, this has to be consistent with Poincaré invariants and Lorentz invariants. That part you would know how to do. For the rest, for dilatation, you will also know how to do. This will be a power expansion in powers of x, 1, 2, and derivatives, so that you don't change the dimension. You know, x, 1, 2 times derivative doesn't change the dimension. And you can fix the coefficients in the power series expansion by acting with the conformal generators on both sides, OK? Now, so that's one way to do it. Another where you can derive, by the way, something that should not be obvious completely, but it is a fact, is that actually this guy, a priori, is some tensor CIJK that we don't know about. It turns out that the contribution, when you look at the primary of this CIJK, is precisely the structure constant, is the coefficient of the three-point function. So the operator product expansion, the coefficient that talks to the primary is precisely the three-point function coefficient, okay? So one way to understand that is very simple. Maybe I can say it, not write way too many equations, just maybe point at this. We can try to apply this logic of the OPE here, right? I can apply the operator product expansion of OI, OJ in the three-point function, okay? So this will give me this thing on the left. And now just compare with the expansion here as x1 goes to x2. And then you can compare term by term, and this completely fixes this function, CIJK. I don't remember in the tutorial, is there an exercise about this or not?
Yeah, there is an exercise how to derive three-point function.
No, but about how to obtain the different coefficients in this expansion.
Well, that I don't remember, but
okay. No. But is the logic clear? I'm just applying the OPE to a function that is completely fixed. Okay, so I just apply the OPE here. This defines this quantity that we don't know, so this I had. And now I compare to the expansion of this function, and that fixes it completely. This also makes it manifest that this C hat ijk is fixed in terms of Cijk, the structure constant.
We can just add it to tutorial. It's not.
Yes. I mean, so this word, I could write many equations for it, but I think hopefully it's very clear what this means. Oh man. Okay. So now we're gonna use the associativity of the OPE. So I have a four-point function.
Professor, could you repeat again, justification for three-point function? Because if I have two operators, I naively expect it like I have to put in like two-point correlation function.
Yeah. So the three-point function will reduce to an infinite sum of two-point functions, which you know. So the left-hand side will be an infinite sum of two-point functions that you know, and the right-hand side will be just some stupid function of C and X.
And like, could you comment on like finite radius of convergence? Like,
okay, that's yeah. So the question is, okay, there are many things you could say about that, but you're surprised that there is a finite radius of convergence? Yeah, so you can prove this very rigorously. This is a kind of a mathematical physics thing you can do. And there are several ways to justify it, from less rigorous to more rigorous. So let's start with the less rigorous ones. So this is CFT, okay? That means that there are no length scales.
Yeah.
So if you have a power series expansion in x12, what could possibly be the thing that determines the radius of convergence? It has to be another length scale that you create from your points. And that's the answer. Why it is convergent also is closely related. So you could have asked the same question but you never asked in quantum mechanics. So why does the decomposition of the identity into the sum of the anti-operator into an infinite sum of the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian converge? It's exactly the same issue. In conformal field theory, there is something that I think Mikola will probably have time to explain in the context of two dimensions, something called the operator state correspondence. That means that for every state, there is a mapping between every state and every local operator. This statement is tantamount to the statement that the identity can be resolved in quantum mechanics. Even though you have an infinite series, it's a faithful representation of the identity operator. Now, generically, in a massive theory, you can also do the OPE, but now since you have length scales, like the QCD scale, typically the expansion is only asymptotic. And for example, in QCD, the OPE is only useful at very short distances, which essentially because it's very close to conformal field theory. You're essentially a conformal field theory. Okay, so here actually I'm gonna say it in general, not necessarily for the four operators. So I have this OPE. So I have this four-point function. Now I can try to compute this four-point function in two different ways by applying this OPE idea. And I'm gonna draw these diagrams that should not be confused with Feynman diagrams. But it tells you what the OPE channel is. It tells you who am I fusing with and who and so on. So first I can fuse essentially what the OPE allows you to do is to reduce an arbitrary n-point function to two-point functions. So we represent this diagram. This is a choice I have. I first do the OPE between 1 and 2 and then 3 and 4. And this can be represented by this diagram. It's 1, 2, 3 and 4. That's one way in which you can factorize. That's one way we use. We factorize the four-point function in this OPE channel. And now here, I'll have a spectrum of operators and its descendants that will sum over here, okay? In the OPE of O1 and O2. Of course, this will depend on the details. Just like when you multiply angular momentum in quantum mechanics, well, what do you get in the decomposition depends on who you are tensoring with. So here is the same. But now I can do the following trick. I could have also done the OPE by multiplying instead 1 with 4 and 2 with 3. And this would, and they have to be the same. The answer should not depend, up to some caveat that I will have to qualify. So if I do the composition of the four-point function in this, we call this sometimes the S-channel. I'm using some language, even though this makes it sound like Mandelstam. Anyway, this, the historical reasons for this, like this goes back to string theory, but let's not go into this. The T-channel. So here what I'm doing is, what did I do with the, yeah. So here I'm colliding one with four and two with three. And here I'm, a priori will be the operators in the fusion of one and four. The collection of operators will depend, can be different than the collection here. Now, for I simplified things in our discussion there. But I choose four identical operators, right? Where did I write it? There. I chose four identical operators, and it's clear that this set of operators and this set of operators are the same because I'm just fusing five with five. Yes?
How do these diagrams represent the different pairings I'm struggling to see?
Yeah, so it means that it's like you have car one and car two colliding. So you have operator two and operator one are colliding. They spit out these fellows. I'm colliding car three and four, and things are propagating, and this is the two-point function. You reduce these two things to the two-point function of O that you get in the OPE here with the O that you get here. Yeah, maybe it's not useful, this picture, I don't know. But you may see it somewhere, so.
So like you start from the outsides of the diagram and come in and see which ones.
Yes, by the way, there's another channel I could have drawn. I could have collided one with three, and that's called the U channel. But it turns out that this constraint, so saying that this expansion is the same as this expansion, will give a constraint on the conformal on the CFT data. You could ask, do I get a new constraint by comparing to the U channel? And the answer is no. Okay, I'm not going to prove this, but yeah, you can prove it. It's not very difficult to prove that you don't get any new constraint. Okay, so now I have to write, unfortunately, some nasty equations. I mean, some equations to give this some beef, okay? And okay, so one caveat, of course, is that I'm doing these two expansions. I have to prove for you that in order for this to make sense, that this expansion and this expansion are convergent in a common region. Otherwise, I'm talking nonsense. If you have an expansion of two functions that don't diverge in the same domain, it's like garbage. And I wouldn't do that to you. Not voluntarily, anyway. Okay. So let's discuss the S channel. I'm going to start with some equations, and hopefully. So first, I do the collision here. So I'm going to represent this as C, phi, phi. Because all them are identical phis, right? And I'm spitting out here these O's, okay? So C phi phi O. Sorry, before that I should define that if I do the OPE of phi x1 phi x2, let me write it once and then get it over with, can be written as a sum over all primaries of the three-point function, the structure constant of phi phi and O, and then the contributions of the descendants that can be factorized in this way, A, x12, d2 of ox2. I'm just writing the same thing I wrote here, except that here, by doing this exercise that I told you in words, we already established that the contribution of the descendants, the tensor in the OPE for the primary, is the same as the three-point function. So that's why I factor it out. And then this guy is just a polynomial that starts with 1, which is the contribution of the primary, and then the second term will be, so this CA will look like CA of X delta. Forget about the A. So here, I forgot an A. It's something like 1 plus alpha X dot derivative plus beta X mu, X nu, d mu, d nu, et cetera, et cetera. And by doing the exercise I told you in Word, you can compute very easily what alpha and beta is, okay? Just some numbers that get increasingly nasty. Okay, so this was all to say that I'm gonna plug in this formula into this OP. So now I have to erase this. Yeah, this is always very tricky to keep in one blackboard, but. So this is the contribution of the primary from this collision. From this collision, I get C phi phi O prime. So that's why I'm summing from O and O prime. Okay. And now I put the contribution of the descendants. And now, what did I do? Now, what I'm left with is the two-point function of OA with OB, right? That's the whole point of the OPE. You can always branch out into the two-point function. But now, what's the two-point function? It's the guys that were in the middle, which are these OAs from, that come from that side and OB that comes from this side. So I got the two-point function of OA of X2, OB of X4. But now we're in business because we know that the two-point function is completely fixed. The position dependence is completely fixed. So we've reduced this horrid thing into things that we know. In things that we identified that appeared earlier. So these are the three-point functions, and these are the two-point functions. So in this guy in particular, so this OA in general is a primary, but it can have Lorentz spin, okay? So here the formula that I wrote there was only for the Lorentz scalar, when always a scalar operator, but you can do the same thing, and I think you'll do it in the exercises. You can do it like for a vector or a rank 2, like for the energy momentum tensor. It's still true that it's completely fixed. The only difference is that now you have a tensor here that soaks up the Lorentz indices. I guess, the Lorentz indices of the operators here. And then here what I have is x24 to the 2 delta of the operator that runs here. And this is, you can always choose on orthogonal basis. So what's the data here? We have that these OPE coefficients. Notice that in this expansion, you sum over all the dimensions of your primaries. This delta O is that a priori we don't know anything about, okay? So you have the deltas of the external legs, right? Of the files, but then you have the deltas of the operators that run in the OPE, okay? Yes.
It's phi a scalar here? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but notice, yeah, so exercise. In the OPE of two scalars, you can get non-trivial Lorentz tensors because you have these X's that can soak the Lorentz quantum numbers. And the thing that's non-trivial to prove is some non-trivial group theory. Actually, the only very specific representations of the Lorentz group can appear. And these are the symmetric traceless representations of the Lorentz group, okay? So yeah, in the OPE of, in particular, you can get the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so all that I'm doing is just patching the OPE and reducing to the two-point function. And now I can write this as, let me do it. Introduce some notation. Let me write it again. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. I can write this as x12. Now I'm gonna compare it with the most general form the four-point function can take, right? I'm comparing it with this. So I'm telling you what G is, essentially, in terms of the CFT data. So notice that I'm distinguishing delta phi, which are the external punctures, external operators, with delta O's, which are the operator, are the dimension of the operators that run in the OPE. And here I can write it as sum over these guys, the guys that run in the OPE, phi, phi, O, square is very important. So that's, you have some positivity here. You have the coefficient of something square. Times these functions, delta, the G delta of the unspin. Of the operator, okay? And if you wish, I can just read from there what this G is. This is just x1, 2, 2 delta phi, x3, 4, 2 delta phi, CA, x1, 2, D2. I'm just writing what I wrote before. I don't know what I'm doing, but so that you don't tell me I didn't write it. And IAB of x2, 4. X24 to the 2 delta. Okay? Okay. So I'm going to try to give you an intuition of what this is. And by the way, this function itself, this function, is completely fixed by conformal invariance. It's just a statement about symmetry. So I'll give you an example. Let me try to give you some intuition of what's going on here from other things that you know. Essentially, what I'm saying is the 4-point function can be written as, if you wish, as a contribution of all the primaries, and this geo encodes the contribution of all the descendants. Okay, this is if you wish, when you do, for example, scattering in quantum mechanics and you have a spherically symmetric potential, you know that the S matrix can be decomposed into partial waves, or where different components of the partial wave are labeled by the rotational quantum number. This is exactly the same thing. So these guys are to a spherical harmonic, and this is the analog of a spherical harmonics for rotations for the conformal group, for the conformal algebra. Okay. So if you can think of these G's as harmonics of S2, D. So I'm just decomposing the answer into different families. Okay. So let me just finish this. But now, what's a non-trivial statement that we get from here? So this is one answer, and this, sorry, I think I lost something. Okay, no, sorry. And this is the same as, now I can copy that equation, right? So this is the same as G UB divided by, what was it? X12 to the 2 delta phi, X34 to the 2 delta phi, right? So this determines G completely in terms of things. The left-hand side is things that we already discussed before, 2 and 3-point function data. So now is where I'm going to use in a very heavy way the associativity of the OPE. A city of the OPE essentially is a statement that I did the collision. I can think of this 4-point function in this channel, or I could reverse 1 and 3, right? But we know that if we reverse 1 and 3, we get this other constraint, right? So I can write the answer either this way or this way. So this tells you. So GUB is fixed in terms of this data. We know what UMB is in terms of the cross ratios. So the non-trivial crossing equation is that GUB is essentially just that equation. The GUB minus U over B delta phi GBU equals zero. The reason that this equation is non-trivial is that, well, it's a, U and B are not the same thing, right? And these are two different ways of packaging this crazy information about C's and deltas, okay? So this is an extremely nonlinear constraint. What's called, this is called the crossing equation. So let me tell you a few things about this and I'll stop. Now you could say, am I smart enough to solve the crossing equation? Like, can I just by pure thought determine from this equation, by consistency of this equation, can I determine all my deltas and all my C's? Now, the thing that's amazing is that this can be done. So completely solve for the CFT data. In two space-time dimensions. So just by never talking about Lagrangians, never talking about anything, just about operators, representations of supraformal algebra, and the crossing equation, you can compute all the critical exponents and all the three-point functions of CFTs. In particular, for example, the two-dimensionalizing CFT that you're familiar with. So this is, I mean, I want to say that this is remarkable. You solve completely the theory just by pure thought. So this is something that the Zamolodchikovs, Belavin, and Polyakov did in the 80s, and it's kind of a amazing stuff. Now, in higher dimensions, we cannot do that. Why? Well, because, as I said, in two dimensions, there are special theories in which the number of primaries is finite. And in two dimensions, you also have holomorphicity. So you can impose a lot of constraints of holomorphicity to solve these equations. In higher dimensions, what people have done, and that's called the conformal bootstrap in D bigger than 2. I mean, this is also called, yeah. Conformal bootstrap is the idea that the theory tells you the constraints that it has to satisfy. So what people have done is essentially they try to study this equation by doing a truncation. So you expand in all possible operators delta O, and you try to, you do an exclusion. You try to find, so essentially you find collections of parameters that are not consistent with this equation. And what you find is there are huge spaces, okay? And so this space has some features. So imagine, okay, maybe let me not go into that. So you have you can carve out regions. I'll say something more about this in the next lecture, but essentially what you can do is you can carve out regions where the data is disallowed. Like you have proven that no one will ever find a CFT with a delta in that excluded region. But if you look at the topology of the excluded region, sometimes it has certain kinks, certain boundaries. And what people observed is that if you zoom in on that boundary, so you have some exclusion region, and you look at some cusp here, so zoom in, what people realize is that, and you compute very precisely what the deltas and the k's are, and the deltas and the c's are, what they found, for example, in three dimensions, they found the world record imprecision of, for example, the critical exponents or the solution of the three-dimensional Ising model. So people before computed like the dimensions of the Ising model using Monte Carlo or using horrible extrapolations from doing exponent expansion extrapolating. This is a rigorous approach. So using this rigorous approach, what's not rigorous is that why the hell does the Ising model live there that no one has given an explanation to? But if you just say, let me study this theory, this seems to be an allowed theory, and you zoom in very precisely, you can get this with extraordinary precision. For example, you can get the delta sigma is like 0.518. I mean, and they know it, I think, like 8 or 7 or 8 decimal points. And delta epsilon is something like 1.412. Notice that this is very far away. These numbers are very far away from what you would obtain if you try to define this from perturbation theory of the lambda phi to the fourth theory. The sigma operator, that's the one that couples to the spin. I mean, you're familiar with the Ising model, right? So you can couple to the spin. That's the phi. But phi in four dimensions has dimension 1. So this is very far away. And this guy is like phi square. So this is also very far away. Good. So given the time, I'll probably stop. But I think you have a question.
Yeah. Can you maybe explain why the derivation of the crossing equations isn't trivial? Because naively, I can see that from the left board, right?
No, but the problem is that the expansion, this expansion here, broke the symmetry between 1 and 3. So up there, so in the abstract world, doing 1 and 3 didn't do anything. But when we computed what G is, we broke the symmetry. So this is definitely not a trivial. I mean, try to write this equation more concretely using this. And you will see that it's definitely not a trivial equation at all.
But I'm still trying to understand why aren't we allowed to do it from...
Okay. Oh, yeah, actually, so let me do it very quickly, and I'll finish with this. Yeah, that's a good point. Sorry, I forgot to mention this. So now let me take the 4 points to be our favorite points. 0, 1, infinity. And then I have x2 is in this plane, right? So in the S channel, if you wish, I'm expanding near the origin, right? I'm colliding two with one, and one is at the origin. Is that clear? So that picture, I put, okay, so this is x1, this is x3, this is x4, and now I'm probing with x2. In that channel, I'm going close to here, but what did I tell you? That the radius of convergence is to the next operator. So there is a radius of convergence. Okay, let me see if I know how to draw this here without making a mess. A circle. Pretty good. So this is the radius of convergence of the S channel expansion. I'm expanding near x2, near x1, and I can go all the way to the next operator, which is here. Now, in the U channel, I'm taking x2 near x3. So now, what is the radius of convergence? What is the next operator? Is this guy. So in the T channel, the radius of convergence is this. So now you see that there is this domain where it's meaningful to discuss this expansion because they have both the same domain of convergence.